Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nancy Altman, president of the group Social Security Works, who takes a critical look at the Republican Party plan to make deep cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Independent journalist Robert Loveis, who examines the GOP's voter suppression strategy employed in many states before this November's critical midterm election. And Andreessen Curtis, an organizer with the ACLU's Smart Justice Campaign in Connecticut, who talks about the goals of the campaign, which includes reducing the prison population by 50% and combating racial disparities in the criminal justice system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Upwards of a million ethnic Uyghur Muslims in western China have been detained in re-education camps. Despite growing condemnation from human rights groups, China is defending the camps as vocational education centers focused on battling extremism and terrorism. Rights monitors say Uyghurs who are ethnically Turkish can be detained for refusing to give a DNA sample, speaking a minority language, or arguing with Chinese officials. Sharat Zakir, Beijing's top official in western Xinjiang province, boasted of the humane treatment in the camps. Camp residents get Chinese language lessons, lectures on the nation's constitution, and job training in assembly, food processing, and e-commerce. Uyghur activists in the United States complain that Chinese authorities have arrested relatives of Uyghurs who speak out against harsh treatment. According to Human Rights Watch, the camps are a systematic attempt to wipe out any sense of Islamic, Uyghur, and Kazakh identity. A U.S. government commission on China alleges that the Uyghur camps are the largest single mass imprisonment of an ethnic minority since World War II. Sophia Richardson of Human Rights Watch asserted, "It's up to the rest of the world to point out that the arbitrary detention of an ethnic minority is grotesque and unacceptable." The trial of the accused killers of Berta Cáceres, the award-winning rainforest activist, fell apart in mid-September. Lawyers for the Cáceres family filed papers against the court for arbitrarily rejecting key evidence, including witnesses and documents pointing to a broader conspiracy in the March 2016 murder of Cáceres. For years, Honduras has been considered one of the most dangerous places on earth for eco-protectors. Cáceres, who won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize, was murdered during a broad-based campaign she led to stop the 21-megawatt Agua Zarca Dam. The company licensed to run the dam, DESA, has been implicated in the killing of Cáceres. According to the Guardian newspaper, two of those charged in her murder worked for the energy company, including the security director, Douglas Bustillo, a U.S.-trained Army lieutenant. Victor Fernandez, one of the lawyers for the Cáceres family, warned that the family will not remain silent about institutional abuses and vowed to expose the criminal structures responsible for this murder. On September 17th, the Honduran Supreme Court indefinitely suspended the trial of the eight men charged in Cáceres' murder. The family argues that a pretrial ruling rejecting a petition to call members of the DESA board as witnesses suggests orchestrated bias. The board includes members of the Atala Sabla family, part of one of the most powerful clans in Honduras. California's legalization of marijuana for recreational use has led to reviews of past criminal sentences for the drug's possession or cultivation. The reversal of sentences could have a major impact on communities of color who were hardest hit by harsh marijuana laws. Los Angeles, Oakland, and San Francisco are offering people with drug convictions priority opportunities to be licensed in the marijuana growing industry. Other states, including New Jersey and Michigan, are considering similar reforms. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy says reforming marijuana laws could break the cycle of low-level drug offenses that plague communities of color. Researchers have found that whites, blacks, and Latinos use marijuana at similar rates, but blacks are the most likely to be arrested. In Oakland, blacks constitute nearly 80% of those arrested for marijuana possession or sales, despite being only one-third of the city's population. Whites, in contrast, make up only 4% of those arrested for pot. In January, San Francisco District Attorney George Gascones was the first office in the country to announce that it was proactively dismissing or reducing sentences for approximately 8,000 old marijuana convictions. Since then, from Seattle to Philadelphia, district attorneys and city attorneys across the country have pledged to reduce or dismiss hundreds of thousands of old marijuana convictions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
Just 3 weeks before the November 6 midterm election, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky told a Bloomberg News reporter that the cause of the nation's exploding budget deficit were social safety net programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. He went on to say that he favors cuts to these popular programs. The Republicans have long been hostile to these three programs, and under President George W. Bush, unsuccessfully tried to privatize Social Security just before the 2008 financial meltdown. Contrary to McConnell's assertion, the ballooning U.S. deficit can be directly traced to the massive tax cuts, primarily benefiting the nation's wealthiest families and large corporations, passed by the Republican-controlled Congress and signed into law by Donald Trump last year, which will add $1.9 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. Defenders of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, along with their allies among congressional Democrats, are now telling voters that McConnell's comments confirm their prediction that the Republicans' plan all along was to try to pay for its tax cut for the rich by slashing social programs benefiting working families. Your reporter spoke with Nancy Altman, president of the group Social Security Works, who talks about the looming battle to protect the nation's popular retirement and health care programs in November's midterm election.
It is so outrageous what they're doing. It reminds me of the story about the child who kills his parents and then pleads to the court for compassion because he's an orphan. I mean, these guys created a huge increase in the deficit. Every economist said this was going to happen. They said, oh, no. But they did it as a reward to the donors who'd been supporting their campaigns. And sure enough, we all said, okay, this is their playbook. They hate Social Security. They hate Medicare. They hate Medicaid because these are programs that American people overwhelmingly support and work so well. And they are a manifestation of government at its best. So they are out to destroy all three programs. And sure enough, before the ink was even dry, you had Marco Rubio and Paul Ryan talking about, oh, we're going to have to cut what they call entitlements, but what we know are our earned benefits, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And sure enough, just last week, Mitch McConnell said the same thing. And my concern is, if this is what they're saying a few weeks before an election, they are going to be so emboldened if they retain control of the government. So people who care about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid really must vote, and they must vote Democratic because the Republicans are out to get these programs.
Nancy, maybe you could speak to what's at stake in this year's midterm election, given the fact if Republicans retain the House of Representatives and continue their control of the U.S. Senate and the White House under Donald Trump, you have a situation where Republicans could actually follow through on their commitment to make deep, deep cuts to these very popular programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
What are your worst fears in terms of continued GOP control in the legislative and executive branch?
I am so worried. I'm more worried. As I said, I've been working on this for 40 years, and I'm more worried now than I ever have, because the very fact is that if they are saying they want to cut these programs before the election, they will know that 2019, they're as far away from the next election as you can get. And they have no guarantee that they will retain control in 2020 of the White House or Congress, and they will be hell-bent to ram these cuts through. Now, they tried in the last Congress. You know, there was the vote over the Affordable Care Act and the pre-existing conditions that really it was just John McCain, the late John McCain, as everyone knows, that famous thumbs down, that had very serious cuts to Medicaid in it. And they talked about also undermining Medicare's funding. They've already been trying, and they will be emboldened. We will have the fight of our life on our hands, and I don't know that we can stop them, because we've got so many distractions that they will try to push this through in secret, in the dead of night, and we will try to get the word out. But if they have all branches of government, they will control the news, and it's going to be very, very hard. You know, for lots and lots of reasons, we have a system of, we're supposed to have a system of checks and balances. And if Democrats take at least one House of Congress, that will be a check on this legislation. They can still do things administratively, and they're trying, closing field offices, making it harder and harder to access benefits, waiting forever on the telephone if you try to get through to get information and so forth. And we need to fully allow the Social Security Administration to do its job and not this death by a thousand cuts. But at least we can stop legislation. And then when we get a supporter of Social Security in the White House, we can turn the administrative part around too. But if we lose Congress, if this is the way they're talking before the election, you know they are going to go as hard as they can, and it will be very hard to stop them.
That was Nancy Altman, president of the group Social Security Works. Learn more about the battle to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in this November's midterm election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the nation's political parties and activists prepare to get out the vote for their candidates in the upcoming November midterm congressional election, the specter of voter suppression could subvert a true reflection of the public's political choices. Since 2010, 24 Republican-controlled states have enacted laws making it more difficult to vote, primarily targeting poor, minority, and young voters most likely to support Democratic candidates. Massive voter purges in Georgia, Indiana, Ohio, Colorado, and other states have shown a harsh light on another form of voter suppression tactics. Republicans claim that more restrictive voting laws are necessary to prevent voter fraud, but dozens of studies have confirmed that the GOP charge of massive illegal voting is a deliberately false narrative designed as a rationale to suppress the votes for their political rivals. The 2013 Supreme Court decision in the Shelby County versus Holder case effectively gutted a key provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that required 9 states with a history of election discrimination, mostly in the South, to secure advance federal approval to change their voting laws. After the high court ruling, these states quickly enacted new restrictive voting laws, many later challenged in federal court. Your reporter spoke with Robert Lovis, an independent journalist based in St. Louis, Missouri. Here he discusses his recent Progressive Magazine article titled "How Voter Suppression Imperils the Midterms."
The sheer variety of voter suppression tactics combines to sort of weigh on would-be voters and discourage them. But there are a few things that stand out in terms of tactics. And one of those is just more laws. And 24 states have stricter voting laws than they did in 2010. So these laws are going to be in effect this November. And this wave of voter suppression laws tracks basically a backlash against the administration of President Obama, elected in 2008, America's first black president. So we have a variety of laws that have shortened early voting. They've introduced strict photo ID laws. They have limited student voting, even on for college kids, requiring proof of citizenship. That's something that we saw Chris Kobach attempt in Kansas, where he's the Secretary of State and where he's running for governor. That onslaught of laws is remarkable, considering the fact that so many of them have been passed since the Supreme Court ruling in Shelby County versus Holder, which weakened the Voting Rights Act, and it seemed to open the gates wider for these kinds of laws to take effect. And I think the other thing that is worth noting is the effort by particularly red states to purge voter registration rolls. It's a normal thing to clean up your rolls when voters move out of a jurisdiction or they die, but in many states this is done in a very hyper-aggressive and unfair way. And the Brennan Center, which is associated with the New York University, they found that between 2014 and 2016 that states purged from their voter rolls roughly 16 million voters. And that's a 33% increase over the number purged between 2006 and 2008. And purging increased more in jurisdictions that had been subject to the Voter Rights Act of 1965 in terms of having to get federal approval to change their voting laws. That pre-clearance mechanism of the Voting Rights Act was essentially eliminated in Shelby County, a decision by the Supreme Court in 2013. So the purging activity is greater in those states and those jurisdictions that had been on a leash, you might say, with the Voting Rights Act.
To fight back against some of these restrictive voting laws, often dreamed up to deprive particular demographic groups of their right to vote, there have been some referendums that are on the ballot this November, and legislation, too, to allow same-day voter registration, universal registration, and make sure everybody is on the books to cast a ballot, and also independent commissions that would be constituted to draw district maps after the next census so that they're not drawn in a very partisan way that locks in the Republican Party, which has been the case over these last 10 years, that have been locked in various congressional seats.
That's right. There is still the power of the ballot box, and in a number of states, we have these statewide initiatives that people are voting on. Florida voters are going to look at a constitutional amendment which would restore the right of felons to vote once they complete their sentences, unless they were convicted of murder or a sex crime. And in fact, there's only four states where a felon, after he finishes his or her sentence, cannot vote. Basically, the majority of states allow felons to regain the right to vote after they either finish their sentence or finish parole or finish probation. In a state like Florida, felons have to seek the restoration of their voting rights on an individual basis as opposed to having it automatically restored. So that's good. And you also have a constitutional amendment in Maryland, which would allow citizens to register to vote on election day. This is called same-day registration. We now have 16 states in the District of Columbia which allow you to register on the day on election day, and that means that you don't have to worry in those states about being purged from the voting rolls, because if it occurred for some reason, might have been a good faith mistake by the voting authorities, or it may have been something more malicious. But either way, you can register on election day to vote, and that expedites things. Also, you mentioned automatic registration. That means that anytime you have a dealing with the government where you're getting a driver's license or you're applying for benefits, that you're automatically enrolled as a voter in the course of that application. You don't have to opt into voter registration in the sense that once you fill out the application, then you say to the driver's license office, well, please use this for my voter registration application. You're automatically registered. So those are things that citizens can work for in their own states and basically take matters in their own hands.
That was Robert Lovis, an independent journalist based in St. Louis, Missouri. Find a link to his recent article titled How Voter Suppression Imperils the Midterms by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The American Civil Liberties Union's Smart Justice Campaign is calling for an end to mass incarceration in the U.S. and a support system for people leaving prison to transition back to their communities. In Connecticut, the campaign has held rallies outside of every gubernatorial candidate's debate. Organizers say a majority of Connecticut voters believe it's important to reduce the state's prison population. And according to a recent poll, the overwhelming majority, 87%, including 90% of Democrats, 90% of Independents, and 78% of Republicans, say the state should increase funding for programs that help formerly incarcerated people find jobs, housing, and medical care. Under Connecticut's outgoing governor, Democrat Daniel Malloy, the prison population has dropped from 20,000 to 13,500. But the state ranks sixth worst in terms of black-white racial disparity in the criminal justice system. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Anderson Curtis, a Connecticut organizer with a Smart Justice campaign, who talks about the ACLU's election-related efforts to raise awareness and promote reform in the criminal justice system.
Smart Justice is a campaign run by the people that have been justice involved, whether that's formerly incarcerated, justice impacted through a family member, or justice involved with not a period of incarceration. So we are looking to eliminate racial disparities and reduce the prison population of Connecticut by 50% to further an end of mass incarceration.
You mentioned, I think, three things: representing people who've actually gone to prison, their family members, and people who are justice involved, which I guess means maybe people who cop a plea to a felony and never actually go to jail, but it sort of haunts them. And then you mentioned a bunch of different categories: housing, jobs, transportation. Can you just run through those and say maybe how people in those different categories are affected?
Well, it could be slightly different for each one, but it really gets to the heart of the trauma of the incarceration, how it's not just about the person who's incarcerated. It's about his family and his support system. It's a toll just to go to a facility, you know, maybe it's hours away from your home. You know, you may not have transportation. You may have to rely on a community van to go there, which extends the trip even further. So there's a great sacrifice is really what it's really about. There's the trauma, and then there's the sacrifice of the families that support people that are incarcerated, which continues when you're released because you're still dealing with the collateral consequences. You know, barriers to housing because of your criminal record. So it's like you're still incarcerated in a way. You're still dealing with that. That's what a collateral consequence is. So you may be in the community, but your access to employment, housing, and, you know, basic livelihood is blocked because of your criminal record.
I was actually listening to the gubernatorial debate, and there was quite a bit about criminal justice. And actually, in Governor Daniel Malloy's 8 years in office with his nationally recognized Second Chance Initiative, the number of people in prison dropped from 20,000 to about 13,500.
Dan Malloy has made some progress. However, there's plenty of more work to be done about employment, housing, and, you know, the right to provide for yourself and your family, which combines with, you know, hope and dignity as a human being. That's why our slogan is people and not prisons. And we want to continue to create opportunities for people that are coming home so that they don't return to prison, which is one way of dealing with recidivism, supporting the people that come out in their community reintegration, which is also an economically feasible way to reduce the Department of Corrections budget.
So you want to cut the numbers even more?
Yeah, because that number is not total of the reflected back to justice impacted and justice involved. You have 4,000 to 5,000 people in pretrial detention that haven't even been sentenced yet, that are incarcerated because of inability to make bail.
Right.
Couple that with another 40,000 roughly on community supervision, which includes parole and probation. We're looking to cut all those numbers.
What kind of support do you have?
The support is growing. Right now it's dialogue with the candidates. They will continue to do what they do until the election, and then we'll see where we stand after that. But we're going to continue to engage the community, you know, do different events, you know, attend events in the community until the election. So we will continue to, whereas there may be not any debates, but, you know, we will go talk to various coalitions and things like that, find ways to collaborate with other community members.
And your campaign or the ACLU as a whole, you don't endorse candidates, do you?
Correct. We're really primarily about our campaign to reduce the number of people in prison and eliminate racial disparities in our state through policy, awareness, public education, and creating opportunities and solutions that work for everyone in the state of Connecticut. Because it's not just about families or people that are justice impacted. It's about people in the state of Connecticut, period. As public safety increases in our community, it increases in all communities across the state. And again, public safety is access to education, housing, employment, and, you know, eliminating the racial disparities that are driving these outcomes that we're seeing.
That was Anderson Curtis, an organizer with the ACLU's Smart Justice Campaign in Connecticut. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Florence, Massachusetts, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.